You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, April 10th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Professor of Political Science, International Political Economist, from the Watson Institute at Brown University, Mark Blythe, on his book, Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. Also on the program today, President Obama releases his budget, calling for cuts to Social Security and increased revenues via closing loopholes and taxes for wealthy people. A report on the failure of President Clinton's welfare reform. Also, Occupy Wall Street wins a settlement from New York City in its lawsuit regarding the city's assault on Zuccotti Park. Saturday delivery is back. And finally, why the rich give so much less in terms of a percentage of their income to charity than do the poor. All that and more on today's program. I must ask your indulgence, folks. My unprofessionally trained radio voice is, of course, as you can hear, not at its peak performance today. I am still battling a cold.
So I assume it was even worse yesterday.
Yesterday, there was nothing. Like, literally, I had to speak in a whisper around my house. I had nothing. And I also felt miserable. Today, I just feel mildly miserable. So thank you, Michael and Matt, for holding down the fort yesterday. Very much appreciated. And thank you, people, for your indulgence as I get through this, I don't know what it is, sinus infection, cold, whatnot. So I appreciate the indulgence. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Mark Blythe.
Through the window, I'm looking through a pane of glass. Look through the window.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the international political economist from the Watson Institute at Brown University, Mark Blythe, author of the just-released Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. Thank you for joining us today.
A pleasure to be here.
So, Professor, I mean, let's start with this audience is fairly familiar with the broad outlines of why austerity is problematic. But before we get into why this idea will not die and from whence it came, please just walk us through the three problems that you outline with the problems with austerity.
Sure. There's three general problems. Sometimes these are seen as like the Keynesian response, but honestly, there's nothing Keynesian about it. It's pretty much commonsensical. The first one is distributional. Let's remember the fact that all the way through to 2006, I don't remember too many Republicans jumping up and down about the increase in national debt to 61% of GDP brought on by tax cuts and wars of choice that weren't funded through any taxation. So then Obama wins, you have a financial crisis, you bail out the banks, and then the net effect of that is to push you up to about 80 to 85% of GDP. Now, at the end of the day, you've got 100% of GDP, everyone's freaking out, and the solution is we need to cut back Social Security. So there's a simple question of equity as well as an underlying one of causation. Why is it that when you bail out some of the wealthiest members of societies and basically give asset protection to them and their incomes, the people who have to pay for that are the people at the bottom end of the income distribution who rely on government services? This is a bait and switch of humongous proportions. The second way that it's a problem is compositional. While it makes sense for any single family or firm or even a country to reduce its debt, that is contingent upon having an income from which to save. If everyone simultaneously contracts, as is going on in the Eurozone just now, the net effect is to increase the stock of debt relative to the size of the economy. As the economy contracts, tax receipts go down and the debt gets bigger rather than smaller. And the third one, to riff off Paul Krugman for a moment, is that the confidence fairy story really is a fairy story. The idea that business confidence comes rushing back in response to government cuts, if you go through the formal models used by economists to justify this, it actually says the following. Despite the economy falling about your ears, despite the fact that you might not have a job next week or you don't know if you're going to be able to pay your mortgage, the government has decided to slash 30% of public spending. You now know that 20 years out you're going to be paying less taxes. Buoyed by this, you decide to spend lots of money in the future now, thereby curing the recession and the depression, despite the economy falling about your ears. That is the definition of a fairy story. So there's a question of fairness and equity and causation. There's a fallacy of composition about doing it all at once, which simply doesn't work. And the last one is, it's a fairy story.
I want to just focus on the fallacy of composition, because just walk us through the relationship between the government carrying debt at a time when everyone else is trying to deleverage, and vice versa, and that dynamic right there, which flies in the face of what we're told when a family has to tighten their belt, then government should too. It's just the opposite.
Yeah, although I just said, you know, it makes sense for any family or even a state, there really is a categorical distinction going on here. Let's just think about this for a moment. When a family decides to save and stop spending, it presumably still has an income from which it can save. It cannot issue its own currency. It cannot issue its own debt. Usually, it cannot bring people into the family and tax them across generations to be credible payments for that debt. States can do all that. And when you are the United States and you issue your global reserve asset, which everyone invests to when the economy is in trouble, the dynamics are kind of different. So the whole thing about it is just like a family, right? Whether it's the Swabian housewife of Angela Merkel or Mrs. Thatcher who used to invoke that, or Republicans today, that is a nonsense story. But the more important point, the more important way of thinking about it is the following. Imagine that the economy is a fraction. Let's say you've got 80% debt to GDP, which sounds like a lot. So 4/5 is a fraction. Now, let's say the government decides that it's going to take out 20% of all expenditures in the economy. It's going to cut its spending in half, really credibly commit to this policy. Then what you've done is you basically turn 4/5 into 4/4. You now have a 1 rather than a 0.8. You've got 100% debt to GDP. That is what's happened to every country in Europe that has undergone an austerity program since 2010. They have more debt rather than less, even controlling for the recession and the effects of the financial crisis. This is self-defeating. We knew this from the 1930s. In the 1930s and the 1920s, the Brits tried to cut and cut and cut and cut. In 1931, they had, if I remember correctly, 150% of GDP, debt to GDP. By 1933, they had 170, despite the cuts.
Now, what do you make of the argument that we will hear that, well, in that example you gave of four-fifths, the bottom line is if the government stops borrowing money to fund these its spending, then it will open up the opportunity for the private sector to borrow that money and put that money to good use.
Well, that's the classical notion of crowding out, right? Now, if what's happening is the government's borrowing all the available money and there's no money left for the private sector, you should see that real interest rates will rise because, crudely, that's the price of money. And what do we have? We have real interest rates on the floor. Now, you can come back and say, well, that's because Bernanke is suppressing the real price of capital. But if you look around the world, interest rates are on the floor everywhere. Meanwhile, business is sitting on enormous stockpiles of cash. And if you look at it, you'll find that corporate profits, even during this recession, have never been higher. So the idea that the government's eating up all the available capital is simply incorrect. They're borrowing money that is out there because people want to hold the global reserve asset because the world is fundamentally uncertain. That's what's going on. This is why companies are sitting on large stockpiles of cash, because they don't know that investing just now is going to reap the returns that sitting on basically a reserve asset gives you.
Before we get into the history of this idea of austerity, we also just speak briefly about the impact that that trade has on this dynamic. When we look around the world right now, we're seeing how austerity is destroying Europe. It is at least taking a hold in this country to a certain degree, a lesser degree, and is at the very least slowing down our recovery. But give us a sense of what the implications of trade are also on this dynamic.
Well, trade's very important if you are, and this particularly in the case of the European Union, you've got lots of countries that are all tied together with a common currency, and you are each other's major trading partners. So if they all decide to cut at once, that old four-fifths turning into four-fourths, then what you do is you shrink the regional economy overall and actually make the situation worse. So if you're heavily interdependent with trade, then trade becomes a channel through which austerity compounds effects rather than makes things better. If you look at the EU's reports on this, they say that austerity is working, and one of their indicators is that people are importing less and they're exporting more. Well, we can't all run a surplus. We can't all export at once. What's actually happened is that imports are shrinking because the economy is collapsing and internal demand and consumption is falling. So it's a question of how you look at this. From the rosy-tinted view of the European Commission, everything's fine and eventually we'll get there. But from the way that I look at it and other people look at it, what you have there is an economy that's decided to eat itself.
And let's talk about the evolution of this idea of austerity, because it has been around for quite some time. Where did it come from?
You have to honestly go all the way back to basically the origins of capitalism in England and the post-Civil War settlement and people like John Locke and then the Scottish Enlightenment of Smith and Hume and others. And basically you have this wonderful tension that goes on between markets and states. So the standard sort of Smithian story is that individuals create markets and the state's out there to try and steal your money. Well, there's a more sophisticated version if you actually read Locke and Smith and others. And what they basically acknowledge is the following. I'll quote Smith for a moment. Smith says that for every rich man, there must be 500 poor. And because of that, he is surrounded by jealousy. And if it wasn't for the strong arm of the magistrate, then basically his stuff would be stolen. So why do you need a state? You need a state to police the inequalities that untrammeled markets make possible. But here's the kicker. In order to be strong enough to do that, you need to have a state that's big enough and powerful enough to police those inequalities, which means you have to pay for it. And the trouble is you don't want to pay for it. So there's a dilemma at the heart of this. You don't acknowledge that the state makes markets possible, but it does. You don't want to pay for it, and you don't trust it. So here's a little wheeze that comes up. It's called government debt. How about the government pays you to lend it money? That'd be like a financial free option, the best of all possible worlds. But the problem is, by doing so, and this is the classical story from which austerity springs, the government has to offer you a rate of interest greater than you would get in normal pursuits. As a consequence, and this is the crowding out argument, all the money gets diverted into government debt rather than the real economy. We end up with more and more debt. We indebt ourselves, eventually become in hock to foreigners, and then eventually the economy collapses. So debt is at once an elixir and a poison. It's something which gets over this can't live with it, can't live without it, don't want to pay for it problem, but it ultimately creates its own problem, which is the indebtedness of the nation and the bankruptcy of the nation. Now, seen in that way, any government that grows too big or issues too much debt, whatever that threshold is seen to be, is on the road to ruin, and that's the inevitability, and that's where the idea comes from. There's just one slight problem with this rendition of events. It's not true. At the time that Hume wrote this, Britain was emerging from the Napoleonic Wars and had a huge amount of debt, and he thoroughly thought that Britain was going to be bankrupt. It went on to dominate the global economy for 100 years.
Now, and in the context of our economy in this country, there's even more problems with that story. I mean, do we have a sense of, I mean, I know that Reinhardt and Rogoff have basically come out and said that 90-some-odd percent of GDP is sort of the magic threshold where everything falls apart. But do we have any really sense that that's even an issue in the context of a post-gold standard world in this country? I mean, do we have any sense of, is there actually a point where that debt can bankrupt our country?
Well, that's an interesting thing about the Reinhardt and Rogoff study. I mean, basically everything you look at is either on a fix or on a gold standard. So if you have your own exchange rate and you can adjust to the exchange rate, this doesn't seem to be the case. It also is a case that size matters. When you are the United States and you issue the currency that everyone else has to earn in order to conduct foreign trade, it kind of changes the game. And we have a big natural experiment going on just now. You've got a bunch of countries in Europe all tied together that basically are about the same size as the United States, and they've been cutting their way to a depression. Meanwhile, the United States hasn't been doing that, and it's in a stuttering recovery, but at least it's in recovery. And the longer that takes hold, the more the divergence grows. So we do have a lot of evidence that this 90% thing really isn't true. The United States above 90% is growing a lot faster than Europe. So there's a bit of a chimera in that one to start with. But the key lesson here is what cures debt is growth. You can chip away at the nominal debt all you want. You can basically cancel government programs and send people home on furloughs and all this sort of stupid stuff. But at the end of the day, unless you're really, really willing to take 20%, 30% of GDP out of circulation, as the Greeks have done, and it hasn't done them any good whatsoever, you're just playing budgetary games. What gets rid of debt is growth. Consider the following. The United States hasn't actually paid back all of its debt from fighting the Civil War. You tell people this, they get shocked. You go, but think about the relative size of the United States economy then relative to it now. If my income doubles, the mortgage I've got now is half of the problem it was before. Growth cures debt. Cuts make debt worse.
Right. And in fact, our debt was a function, rather than the crashing of the economy being a function of debt, the debt was a function of the financial crisis.
Yeah, well, there's a long sort of process of accretion, and there is blame on both parties here. I mean, when you know you can issue the global reserve asset, you get lazy. Now, you know, I'm perfectly fine with basically paying back debt. I don't think you should have excessive debt, however you define this. If the United States doesn't have to pay hundreds of billions of dollars in interest, then perhaps it shouldn't, and then we'd have more money for investing in things we actually want. But when you do this, you do it when you're growing. And this is a Keynesian line, but it's also a very commonsensical line. The boom, not the slump, is the time for austerity. The problem is not the economics. There are no such thing as Keynesian politicians. No one, Democrat or Republican, stands up in the Senate and says, everything's going great, the economy's humming along, we're all making a fortune, let's raise taxes. That just never happens, and that's exactly what you're meant to do in order to pay back debt. So we don't do that, so we dig our own grave. The financial sector was, the financial bailouts were just the most egregious example of that.
Let me ask you, why do you think that this idea has not died, this idea of austerity? We see what it's doing to Europe. We now even have the IMF coming out and saying, hey, this is, we finally decide this is a bad idea. Why does it continue?
Well, part of it is because we've been living through, as people call it, the neoliberal era, whereby for 30 years we convinced ourselves that markets were good and states were bad, and states only ever got in the way and left to their own devices. People with skin in the game would make optimal choices, and boom, then you have the financial crisis. And in a sense, it takes people a while to realize that what this means is a lot of the ways that they thought about the world and the way the world worked is actually wrong. But more deeply, it resonates, because most people don't have the time to sit down and work out fallacies of composition, to figure out how the balance of payments works. That's all complex and time-consuming stuff, and also is error-prone. You ask the IMF for their forecast for 2004, I bet they said that 2008 would be a nice year. So, you know, let's grant some kind of, let's say, generosity to the common sense of the man in the street. But at the same time, common sense solutions can be deeply misleading, because it's deeply counterintuitive that cutting debt can lead to more debt if everybody tries it at the one time. So there's many reasons, and also there's ideological reasons. There are people out there like Grover Norquist who will do anything by any means necessary to drown the federal state in a bathtub, quote-unquote. So you add all this together, ideology, epistemic arrogance, laziness, time, and you end up with a bunch of people who say, well, you've got too much debt, just cut it. It's common sense. But yeah, but that common sense is a nonsense.
And just speak briefly as well about the so-called rebel alliance. One of the examples we hear quite a bit of austerity working is, among other places, Estonia. But that's not really an accurate depiction. And in fact, austerity, as in practice, aside from it being theoretically nonsensical, in practice, it has never worked to bring about any type of growth, has it?
Well, there are things that look like austerity that are often cited as examples. So you think about Canada and Ireland in the 1980s. These are the great cases. They basically cut their debt and they grew. Well, part of the reason they did this is because 75% of their exports each go to a country right next door, the United States and Britain, respectively. Those are big economies were expanding. The small economies are export-dependent. And they did a huge devaluation. The loonie lost 40% of its nominal value over a 10-year period. That's why you grow. It's not because of the expectations of consumers or people start spending more because they think they'll be paying less taxes in the future. It's a simple devaluation and real wage growth story. So that's part of the reason. We confuse things that aren't austerity effects for austerity effects. But the ones that are being hawked around now, you know, the success of the Baltics. I mean, the reason these guys had to be so austere in the first place is because they privatized their entire banking system to the point that foreign banks owed their money supply. When the crisis hit in 2008, the Swedish and German banks threatened to pull all the money out of these systems, effectively pulling all the liquidity out of these economies. So in return for keeping the money there that was actually not theirs to start with, it was the depositors' money, the trick that was signed in Vienna in 2009 was to guarantee the balance sheets and bondholders of senior banks and senior bondholders of banks in Germany and Sweden by basically cutting the pensions of people in Estonia. They went through a huge, huge slump, and then they had a huge, huge bounce back. You know when the bounce back started? When they stopped doing austerity. Hmm. There are automatic stabilizers in the economy. People who say that, you know, intervention is a bad thing, they have a point, because cutting is an intervention too. It's symmetrical. You've got to have both sides of the story here. Spending's an intervention, but so is cutting. And when you cut, it's contractionary. There is no evidence that these things produce positive expectations of future growth. Quite the contrary. If you look at the Eurobarometer data, the most economically pessimistic people in Europe are the Latvians and the Estonians. So this story simply doesn't explain the case that it supposedly does.
All right. So finally, I mean, what will bring about the demise? Will we ever end this this allegiance to this this failed economic idea of austerity?
Unfortunately, what tends to do that is when the politics generated it by it become extremely ugly. And we're not there yet, but the warning signs are already there. You have Golden Dawn in Greece. You have Beppe Grillo, who's basically the unfunny version of Stephen Colbert, being the kingmaker in Italy. You've got ructions in Spain continuing, a collapse in the vote of the major centrist parties that have been the main sort of bastions of democracies in these supposedly stable countries. Let's remember that what happened in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, in closing, the Germans will tell you the stories about the inflation, but the inflation ended in 1924. And between 24 and 28, Germany was one of the more stable and prosperous and growing economies in Europe. A lot of us borrowed American money, and that money went flying out in response to the Wall Street crash. And at that point in time, the Germans had no alternative because they thought the way to go was to cut. So they started to cut, and they started to cut, and they started to cut. And a very minor party called the National Socialists, who were polling less than 10%, suddenly got 18% of the vote. And then they were in the 20s, and then they were in the 30s. And then by 1933, by the time that Adolf was elected, they had 43% of the vote. So we should be very, very careful in these Panglossian estimates of just another 5 years of chronic unemployment, misery and suffering for people at the bottom of the income distribution. Because at the end of the day, they will protect them themselves, but they will protect themselves in the worst possible way for all of us.
All right. Well, Professor Blythe, I appreciate your time today. I know that you are strapped for time. And I'd love to speak to you.
Going to run for the Amtrak.
Yes, we'd love to speak to you again in the future. Thanks for taking the time today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. We had a little bit of wanted to have a little bit more time. We got a little more time out of him than I thought we would have today, at least secondarily. And we will have him back. Would love to just also a great person to speak about the legacy of Margaret Thatcher. The book is a definite worthwhile read. It is very accessible and gives you a very good explanation of the problems with austerity as we go forward, and also how we got into this mess. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to head into the better half of the program, still on a sick schedule, as you can hear. Folks, your support is what keeps this show alive and also allows me to get things like antibiotics to keep myself alive in these days. So you can become a member today at majority.fm. Again, if you cannot afford it, please send us an email. We're a little bit behind on responding to your emails these days, but we will get there. You can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And by all means, you know, I still have some Obama bots who are tweeting me or emailing me about the chain CPI not being a cut or being a myth or I don't know what, nonsensical things. And on this program, excuse me for one second. On this program, we have libertarians call in. And I will say this, that at least they have the courage of their convictions to call in. I've invited all of these Obama bots to call in and explain to me what you're talking about. I mean, I've seen arguments. They're weak, but at least they're arguments for the chain CPI. But these people won't even make it. It's as if they can't even accept the fact that the reality of what the president is proposing. So by all means, call in. You know, you're being upstaged by libertarians. And that's super, super embarrassing. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. And you can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back after this.